Hello and welcome to Homer Grown. This is a bi-weekly show about gardening, agriculture, and local producers meant to encourage, empower, and educate gardeners. We strive to provide diverse voices by interviewing experts and garden enthusiasts. Although the name of this show is Homer Grown, our goal is to provide information relevant and applicable to the broader Kenai Peninsula. My name is Desiree Hagen, and I live on a micro farm in Fritz Creek, Alaska. On the farm, we raise goats, and I know that they would be extremely upset if we did not provide them with local hay. Today, we'll be talking about hay. In this episode, we interview Chris Rainwater, the board chair of Homer Soil and Water Conservation District, and the president of the Alaska Association of Conservation Districts. He's been raising beef cattle at the head of Ketchumak Bay for many years. He grows hay to feed his herd through the winter months on the family homestead. We talked with Chris about hay. And Catherine Shakey from Homer Soil and Water Conservation District talks about weed-free gravel, hay, and straw. A note to the listeners. During the interview with Chris Rainwater, it began raining hard, and you can hear that in this interview. Consequently, I was unable to ask a few of the questions that I had prepared, so I wanted to take a moment to clarify a few things before this interview. Many people are unaware of the difference between straw and hay. Straw, by definition, is an agricultural byproduct consisting of the dry stalks of cereal plants after the grain and chaff have been removed. Although straw may be fed to certain animals as a supplement to their diet, it lacks the nutritional content of hay. I like to think of straw as an insulation or a fiber. A lot of times it is used for bedding for animals. It can be used as a construction material or fiber, such as straw bale building or straw clay fiber. And on the farm I live on, we sometimes use it as a mulch to insulate the plants over winter. Hay, on the other hand, is grasses, legumes, and other herbaceous plants that are used primarily for feeding livestock. One more clarification. In the interview with Chris, he uses the term ruminants. Ruminants are mammals that eat plant-based foods by fermenting it in their stomachs prior to digestion. They're often animals that chew over things. The word ruminant comes from Latin, which means to chew over again. These animals include cattle, sheep, antelopes, deer, giraffes, and others. I like this word because you can also use the term ruminate, which means to think about again and again, to chew something over in your mind. The next sound that you will hear is of a tractor-drawn hay baler. So without further ado, let's get started. Chris, can you introduce yourself?
I'm Chris Rainwater. I've been here for a while. I was born in the territory of Alaska and raised by Comanches. This is the ranch that my father and his partner started in 1952. I spent some of my formative years here and then took it over in 1982 or three. And so I've been putting up the hay and breeding the cows and fixing the fences. And of course, playing cowboy politics, you know, for some years now.
You've been doing this since you were a child.
Yeah.
What is hay? Is it just grass?
Well, no, it's not just grass. But hay is the method we use for preserving this feedstuff for our animals when it's not available. Some people around the world have to feed their cows in the dry season, and in the wintertime, everything's fine. Here, we have to feed them in the wintertime. And so one of the cheapest methods of putting up this feed so that it retains its food value is in this dry form. This hay that we see here stacked in round bales has got all kinds of things in it besides grass. The grass is the dominant tonnage, but under the understory is clover and nagoon berries and dandelion leaves, and they're actually the most easily digested of the hay that we feed. So it's a complex deal, this stuff we wind up in string and call it hay.
Are there differences in the quality of hay? For example, I've had to buy hay and people would say, this is first year hay or this is second year hay.
First cutting and second cutting is probably the term that they use. There is differences, lots of differences. And the trouble is that you can't tell at a glance. People have become very good at putting up hay that looks really, really sharp sitting there on a bale on the shelf. But you gotta send it to the lab and get it analyzed. And that's the basis that we use for evaluating our hay when you go to sell it. Show up with a lab analysis, and then we'll talk. Locals around here can judge hay by feel. There was an old boy out of Delta. We were messing around the dairy farm in Palmer, the experimental farm by the university, and they were feeding an exotic feed there. And he just reached in the bin there where the cows were eating and got him a sample and went to chewing on it. He says, that's the way you evaluate this feed, is eat some of it yourself. And not many of us followed his lead. We took his word on it. But the lab analysis is actually the key. In the days when I was taking animal science and learning the trade, the method that they used for analyzing this hay was called the Tilly and Terry method of in vitro dry matter disappearance, IVDMD. That was the process where you actually took rumen fluid out of a cow and shredded this hay up and introduced it into the digestive fluid from a live cow, and then analyzed how much of the hay would go into suspension. And now they use lasers, and they hit it with a laser and take a picture of the smoke and analyze the product that way. Of course, it's faster and quicker. It's not cheaper, but it doesn't allow for what an animal can actually do for digesting it.
Is there certain animals that need better quality hay or different types of hay?
It's just all over the place. The people with the alpacas were looking all over the Western world for a high-fiber hay, which is actually what we would describe as the lowest quality hay you can get. If it's high in fiber, that means it's not digestible, for crying out loud. So all animals need good quality feed. Some of them might need more of it than others. Beef cows and all of these ruminant animals, they actually can make their own protein. What they need out of the hay is the energy. They need the sugars, the raw sugars that you find in these grasses. So one of the easiest to defend observations on that question is the younger animals are the ones that need the higher quality feed. When these young calves and young horses are still growing and in their first winter, they're the ones that need the higher quality feed because their teeth and their digestive systems haven't yet grown to the point of being able to process a roughage. So that's the stuff we select for the young stock, beef animals and colts. That's where you want to put your best feed is into them, because the larger animals, they got these immense teeth that grind this stuff into a very fine, and it turns loose all the nutrients. And the calves still haven't got their big grinders in yet. And so they're the ones that need the high quality feed. I don't know nothing about sheep, and I don't know anything about goats, but bison and horses and cattle, that's a pretty universal truth there. Feed your best stuff to your young stock.
In the Midwest, there is an expression, it's make hay while the sun shines, which is kind of essentially like a blacksmith saying strike while the iron's hot. How can rain damage hay? And can you talk about maybe the immediacy of when it starts raining?
Of course you make hay when the sun shines, except on the Kachemak. And here we have to figure out how to make hay when the rain is falling. Because often there is, the sun is, you know, one day out of five. And so it turns out there is ways that you can make hay while the rain is falling. I swear they invented the disc mower just so that you could mow in the rain, because they knew the next 3 days were going to be sunny and then they could get it dry. But I've got one tractor with a cab, and that was the greatest delight, because then you could bale in the rain. And if you put your windrows deep and large, then even if it's raining on the top of them, it doesn't get to the bottom, can bale in the rain. And now we've figured out how we can mow in the rain. The latest and best invention is shrink wrap bales. And so that technology just came to the Kachemak 3 or 4 years ago with the aid of a baler that'll handle high moisture forage. Then when it spits out of the bale chamber, you can grab it up and put it on this turntable and shrink wrap it. And then the moisture is locked into it, but it won't mold. And mold is the evil that comes with moisture. So they can make hay when the sun shines in the Midwest, but up here we got to figure out how to make it when it's raining.
With the people in the Homer area that do hay, is it more of a competition or a cooperation? I assume maybe you would have to share equipment.
I had a great example of that just this summer. I was just finishing up a section of hay that I'd had down and raked, and I just baled almost the last bale when a great crashing happened in my round baler and the dust blew off, and I got off and looked at it, and there was busted chains and things laying around. And just then the buddy of mine drove up, and he'd been down baling down at Silo for one of the Russian kids who just twisted the main shaft out of his round baler. And so Jeremy shows up, and we open the hoods and figure out what it was. And I said, man, I said, if it gives us one more day of sun, I was thinking about raking up that next spot out there and seeing if I could get somebody to bale it for me. And so by and by the next day, I did just that. And it rained at night, and I'm lamenting that I lost that. And I came down the next morning, and Jeremy had showed up and baled that for me without me even more than just hinting. And so here in the field, you can see the net wrap bale with the red stripes on it is the product of his baler. And so it's more of an exportable over-the-road product. They put them in the net wraps because then when you're driving down the road, that doesn't trash up and tatter out. They're much more easy to transport. They're a higher density bale, which is, of course, the problem. Mine will breathe their moisture out of them, but you wrap them tight like that and put a net wrap on them, and they can't breathe, and so you need to have a drier product going into those. But the beauty of his, of course, is it'll bale anything. You talk about competition, and you talk about sharing equipment, and there's both. There's vicious competition for the right to hay people's ground for them. And in the end, though, we know we're all in it together. If one person has a spare tractor, another one has a spare baler, or even a ball of baling twine. I've been willing to give my castle for a ball of baling twine. Lots of times we'll show up and help one another with that.
Who are your customers?
Well, all of my feed goes back into my cattle herd, and so I don't really sell the hay. And then the cattle then produce beef, and that feeds the community. Oh, I sold a semi-load of round bales to the rodeo outfit, and they took it off to Soldotna to feed their roping steers. But that's been 15 years ago, and I don't recall selling any serious hay since then.
How much cattle do you feed with this hay?
Well, I declare that I've got 100 head of cattle. But, you know, that might be, depends on when you take the count. 100 head would be the count going into the fall, and then you sell off your aged cows, and you sell off your fat steers, and maybe some bred heifers here or there, and go through the winter with, you know, 60 or something like that. These things happen, you know, in October and November and December and sometimes in January. We try to make those decisions in the fall before you're on total feed. And many times cows can graze this ground until Thanksgiving or the 10th of December.
So what does your typical haying season look like? How many harvests, or maybe you call them cuttings?
Yeah. We're sitting at elevation 1,100 feet right here. These hay meadows are dominated by timothy, which is a very identifiable grass. It came from the Scandinavian places, probably Norway. And so the time when you want to start your cutting is what they call post-emergent but pre-bloom. And so the head comes out of the grass stalk, and before it throws its flowers out, that's when you want to cut. That's the highest nutrient value versus tonnage that you can get. So it's post-emergent and pre-bloom. That happens here on the 5th to the 10th of July. Downtown, they grow a different grass down there, and it's earlier in its maturity, and they need to kill their grass for the first cutting on the 5th to the 10th of June. But up here with growing timothy, it's the 5th to the 10th of July is when the sweet spot is. And so then, a month later is the regrowth of this stuff. And it can vary depending on how much fertilization you put on it, but in 6 weeks, you can grow enough grass to harvest again. In my case, though, I let this regrowth happen and the cows come in and eat it in the fall. And so I only have to take one crop off of my fields, and then the grass that grows back is eaten by the cows when they come in from summer range.
And then that adds to keeping the soils healthy?
The presence of animals on these grasslands is actually an interesting thing. The bison of the Great Plains of America are a classic example. The grasses that grew there are the grasses that actually need to be grazed and trampled by animals to thrive. They don't even know how come, but they've done exclosures and kept animals off of these grasses that have been, you might say, cultivated by grazing animals. And when you exclude the animals from it, the grasses do not prosper. Nobody has been able to quantify the reasons on that one, but the presence of animals does actually contribute. They, of course, eat the grass and then they leave their droppings. A lot of times they don't scatter them about exactly where you'd like to, especially in the wintertime when you're feeding. And so from time to time we'll grab some of that manure from our feedlot and cast it about on the fields.
Hay is a heavy feeder. Is there anything else that you do to replenish the soil?
Oh man, you describe hay as a heavy feeder. I suppose what you're talking about is what nutrients it needs from the land. Corn is a heavy feeder, and it is actually a grass. But no, I wouldn't describe hay product as being heavy feeders. But it's true, they will deplete the nutrients. If you let them grow and then take the hay, you will end up with deficiencies, and it'll show up within 3 to 5 years. So, you know, we have to put fertilizer back. The cheapest ways of doing that, you know, in the post-war era, was buy it from the fertilizer manufacturers. Then we ended up, when Enron took a run at the natural gas industry, all of a sudden nitrogen ends up being a big deal, and it doubled in price. And then they shut our fertilizer plant down in Kenai, And so our prices up here quadrupled. Fertilizer went to $1,200 a ton.
Because that's, fertilizer is just synthetic nitrogen?
It's actually just nitrogen. The fertilizer plant in North Kenai pulls the nitrogen out of the air and puts it into a pellet that can then be dispersed on your ground. It's actually, you know, atmospheric nitrogen. The phosphorus and the potash, the other two ingredients, are also, you know, natural products in the world. The method of jamming them into a pellet that you can transport around and spread on your field is a kind of a hideous description. But at any rate, so when the price of synthetic fertilizer quadrupled, I got to messing around with the possibility of using fish waste out of Homer. And I set up a digestive tank and started prototyping some equipment and testing some stuff, and I was fascinated by it. And I got to the point where I spread fish waste fertilizer on these hay meadows and could see the response. But I couldn't make a technology breakthrough with the city, and so by and by, the process, you know, the price of synthetic fertilizer starts coming back down, and I find myself back to doing that. You can see the streak out through the hay meadow there. It's a place where some fertilizer got wet and would not process through my fertilizer spreader, and so it was a high-density application. You can see that the grass just loves it. You can put fertilizer on too heavy, and you can actually kill grass with that. You can end up with byproducts out of this fertilizer, and that's a kind of a hideous little sideshow there. There may be things in our synthetic fertilizer that they don't tell us about. But we've been using synthetic fertilizer here since 1964, maybe five. And I think that we haven't managed to poison our ground. The clover is still loving it. Clover is a kind of a good sign that you've got healthy soils.
Is this grass perennial?
I think this grass here that we're sitting in is the same grass that was planted in 1952, the original Ingmo timothy. We've broken and replanted. Sometimes you get winter kill that will decimate the stands. If you get heavy ice, the grass actually smothers underneath it. And so we've broken and replanted from time to time, but I think the cultivars that they had available in 1952 are better than the ones they got now. And so this stuff here is probably the original seed imported from Norway, Ingmo timothy.
Because you have farmed this land for so many years, have you noticed any climate-related differences, maybe in regards to when you harvest the hay or just in general?
I tried to actually throw a study on that and find out if the bloom time on timothy was advancing. I don't think that I can say that. My old man was talking to Jack Dietz, and Jack Dietz, you know, had the place down by the Putter Inn, Wasabi's, and he told my father that from time to time you can get your hay up in May, and I had never seen that, and so I scoffed at the old story until 4 years ago when there was a hay crop put up in May on the Homer bench. But never had been seen for 60 years, but Jack Dietz knew that there was a time. And so, you know, I'm fairly skeptical about observations that we can make in our own lifetime about climate. But I am fascinated by the sharp curve of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, because that's what green plants do. They use the sun's energy to grab carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere and turn it into these things that we see and that their animals eat. And it is known that when the CO2 in the atmosphere goes up, green plants thrive in it. It's one of the reasons that we had coal ages. They're tightly correlated to spikes in CO2 in the atmosphere. And so the productivity of the Earth's surface takes a huge leap. And so we may be facing that. And I think there's evidence that the CO2 in the atmosphere is a driver. If you look around Homer and lots of places now, you see the terminal leader on these spruce trees is 16, 20 inches long. Some people have attributed it to the post-beetle recovery and the thriving spruce trees that have managed to survive the beetle. But I'm thinking that it could be CO2, they have found that the corn grown in America has been rising and rising in the tonnage per acre. And they have to, so far, allow that it's the CO2 in the atmosphere that's driving the tonnage of corn up. And it's a big deal. If it's true that we will get more tonnage from each acre with the same inputs and the same rain, farms can be smaller and still be an economic unit. There's all kind of things can come from that. But we're still kind of sitting back and watching.
Since I've lived in Homer, I've noticed several fields that used to be devoted to hay now being subdivided and sold. What do you see for the future of hay in Homer?
Yeah, instead of growing potatoes or hay, they're growing houses. And it's an irreversible conversion. And so, yes, we watch as our hay fields are being converted. The Homer Bench is such a beautiful place to live in compared to so many places around the world that it's almost inevitable that the arable land down there at less than 500 feet is going to be occupied by houses unless there's, you know, some outside interference. And so there's a couple of programs that were spun up in Alaska that would allow for the purchase of the development rights, and then you could farm it in perpetuity and not have the pressure to sell it to the highest bidder. But both of those, the federal program and the state program, have languished for lack of funds. And it's not a very vigorous program for buying the development rights of private ground. And so the hay fields fall to the houses. Almost every year we lose another one, it seems like.
There's also the issue that people that do hay are an aging population. Is there any incentives for younger people that maybe are doing this kind of work?
I was approached at the coffee shop a week or so ago by a gal from up by Nikolaevsk, and she's got a diversified farm, and she's making all kind of things and selling them, and she wanted to talk to me about how you convert or bring back an abandoned hayfield into production. There is an enthusiasm for growing things and doing real things that skipped a generation. My own generation, the baby boomers, we were engaged with that, but there was so many of us that we could do all kind of things and still have farmers. But I'm encouraged by the millennials that want to get involved with growing their own feed and feeding their own community. It's a big deal.
What is silage?
Well, silage is the alternative to dry hay, and it's used commonly all over the world. Not necessarily because it's not dry enough to dry it, but it's because you're starting with a product that is so wet that let's not depend on the sun to dry it down. So you put this green chop grass, and instead of turning it around and showing it to the sun, you throw it into some kind of a container that will limit the oxygen on it. And what happens then is the sugars from the crop are turned into acids by bacteria, and the acids pickle the crop, and then it's actually good for a long time. It's pickled and preserved just like you would pull pickles or pickled beets out of a jar. That's silage. There was a very rainy time in the early 50s around here, and my father and his partner decided they better figure out how to do silage, and they did. They started by pushing a trench in the ground and just pouring this stuff in. And later on, when they invented polyethylene plastic, then you cover the top. That stuff would heat. First it heats, and then these bacteria take over and they turn the starches and sugars into acids, and it pickles itself. The trouble, of course, is that you use quite a bit of sugar to create those acids, the pickling acids. The bacteria won't stop until the acids are high enough that they can't tolerate their own environment. But how much sugar you have left over is the big deal. And so we find that curing hay in the sun is a better method than putting it in a silo, because sugar is the defining value of this hay when it comes to beef cows. They make their own protein, but they need the sugar and the starches.
Is there a difference between local hay and say the hay that I might get at the grocery store or at a feed store that comes from elsewhere?
Well, we would hope that the wholesalers of hay that were going to be dispersed, you know, in our communities off the shelf would have that same attention to detail. They would do the analysis before they would roll it out, but not necessarily. There was a gal here that went down to Washington State and brought in a semi-load of double-compressed hay and ran an analysis out through my conservation district. We have the lab access so that local people can test their soils and test their forages. And so the results came back when I was there in my district office, and they were so low as to be unbelievable. I said, oh no, I said, we can't take this as a lab test. If there's another sample, we got to send it in and we'll eat the costs. We sent a second sample in and it came back just as low. I hadn't seen a hay analysis that low since 1979 and some scratch hay that came off of here, and yet it was export quality, looking good in double compressed bales and three plastic straps, and you would have thought that it was the best hay in the world, and yet it was not. The lab test showed that.
Is there a way that you can keep your hay weed free?
Oh, weed free. I carry a straight claw hammer stuck in the side pocket of my tractor, and when I see one of these multi-flowered yellow dandelions, I'll get off the tractor and dig it up by its roots. That is actually a desperate way of trying to control your weeds, but so many ways these weed seeds are transported. I have people come out to help me on my cattle drive, and they pull in with their pickup truck and they jump their wheelers off, and right there is where the weeds start showing up. And I've had to do my most vigorous digging there. They fall off of snow machines that come booming in from Palmer, and they bring exotic weeds with them. I say, where did this thing come? And then I remember there was a snow machine trail that went out through there. The cranes have been identified or, you know, accused of having transported some of these weeds. It's possible. But usually the birds that eat seeds have got stones in their gizzard and they grind them up to the point where they shouldn't be viable. But anyway, there's lots of methods where the weeds are transported, and I have resorted to weed killers of the least caustic variety. But it may be in the end, you know, we have to use some pretty severe weed killers in order to make this happen. The cost of invasive weeds through the United States is huge. They, in a laissez-faire kind of an attitude, thought that they could deal with them if they became economic. And by the time you really discover that they are an economic problem, then you are way into it. I was watching the TV and they were scanning out across the area of where ISIS had taken the upper edges of Iraq. And I recognized one of these weeds living and thriving out there. And it's the same weed they've got over there. They had them, you know, 1,000 years ago. And I think it's contributed to how few damn goats there are left over there, because it's dominated by these weeds. And the reason the weeds don't get eaten by the goats is because they're not palatable, let's put it that way. And so we're fighting the same weeds that they've fought in Mesopotamia and the Caucasus. We are now fighting them. The orange and yellow hawkweed, and there's a few other hideous ones. We sent a weed scout out into the Kuskokwim, and he come back and said, man, they've got black bindweed out there. And it came in from the bedding straw for the Iditarod dogs. That was one of the worst crimes against humanity that we ever perpetrated in Alaska, is allowing that kind of bedding straw to go out in the wilderness and start these invasives out there.
So is there a difference between timothy and some of the other grasses? Or some people grow alfalfa. You had mentioned clover.
So there's one place in Alaska that declares they can grow alfalfa, and it's the Copper River Basin. For some reason, they have neutral to alkaline soils out there, and that's what it takes to grow alfalfa. Here, the soils are too acid. And so we deal with grasses and maybe some of the legumes, the clovers and field peas and vetches. I used to describe my hay mix as timothy, bluegrass, and clover, but it has changed. I now have timothy, brome, and clover, and the brome was living down there like a mouse under the feet of elephants for 40 years, but for some reason, and I don't know whether it is climate change or what, but the bluegrass has walked back to take that little place, and brome is now emerging. And I think if I had to declare, you know, what it was, it's soil temperature. But the brome is a very beautiful hay grass. It just wouldn't thrive here in the 50s and the 60s and the 70s. Because it has more leaf per unit of height than timothy, and creatures that love leafy hay love brome. And so now I have brome, timothy, and clover as the dominant species in my hay fields.
So I was told that I should ask you about Bruce Willard and his style of hay.
He was the one that put the rain gear on and went out and cut hay in the rain. I was the first one to convert to a round baler. And then you got to get the tractor that'll pick it, and you got to figure out how to stack it in your barns and everything. And Willard was still putting up 10,000 square bales and losing lots of them to the rain. And so one time when I was finished with my hay crop, and he had more hay out there than he could figure out what to do with, I said, let me just show up tomorrow and round bale some of this for you. And I did. I jumped out there way out in the caribous and spun up some of these round bales. And so when they pushed all the square bales over the canyon rim the next spring because they had failed to get them in, the round bales were still green inside. And he got a round baler that very next winter. So we've all got round balers, and now some of us got two round balers, and there's round balers have taken a big piece of the hay market around here. And it's not very compatible with marketing to small animals and small herds because they come in such big packages. You set one of these round bales of mine in the back of your pickup, and you're lucky if you can see out the mirrors. They're six wide.
Is there a difference between the square and round bales? I mean, it sounds like the hayers here prefer the round bales.
Well, I tell you, there's a couple of reasons there. The one that I point to is that in order to get a square bale to cure and not to grow mold inside, you got to have the humidity has got to be about 5 points lower than it does when you put it in a round bale. In order to get there, they've invented this tool called a tedder. Some of them are two rotors and some of them are four rotor tedders, but in the process of stirring this grass up and getting it up in the air where it'll dry, what you do is you knock off all of the little highly digestible pieces of it. And so you might have a nice bright bale of hay in your square bale, but it doesn't have all of the little broadleaves that have the highly digestible stuff. So me, I try to disturb this hay as little as possible and just rake it up and bale it immediately so that I don't have what they call leaf shatter and losing those little fine little highly digestible portions of it, like the leaf on the clover. Not many of those will make it into a square bale because they get shattered off and they hide in the stubble.
There's a lot of big tools that are used for haying.
Well, your primary mover is your tractors. They've come through three or four generations since I have witnessed tractors. This one standing in the weeds behind us is what I call an N model Ford. They made three variations on that theme, but they were all a four-cylinder flathead. They did not have live PTO power. They did not have remote hydraulics. And they were a very, very simple tractor, and so even homesteaders that didn't have a bunch of background could make them run. Now, though, they've gone to three different generations. My tractor that I use primarily for this has got two remote hydraulics. It's got two speeds on the PTO. It's got live clutch and wet clutches. It's a beautiful piece of machinery, even though it is still at least one generation older than the new models. The new models have taken the fuel efficiency, and that comes with computerized individual fuel injection and turbos and also computers. But the most horrifying piece of the newest tractors is that you might buy the tractor, but you have not bought the electronics. And so you're dependent on the dealer to troubleshoot the electronics, and that means your tractor might be sitting for 30 days while they fuss around. And it means you got to have two tractors because one of them's going to be down. The tractors that I'm talking about were the ones that you could work on yourself. You could pull them into the shop in the wintertime and do a major overhaul on them. And so the latest generation of tractors is not that kind of technology. It's the kind that you got to take back to the service dealer. Of course, the cost of shipping things is getting cheaper all the time. We've got all kind of interruptions now because of COVID coming through Canada, but the cost of bringing that kind of technology in is not prohibitive. It might cost you $1,000 more, but on a $60,000 tractor, that's not actually a consideration. The technology that we find out in our fields, though, is all over the place, from the most simple of the N-model Fords all the way up to the electronically driven modern tractor. And you got to have a module up in your tractor so that you can monitor your round baler. It's appalling. I might want a net wrap round baler, but I don't want one with a computer in it.
Is there anything that you would want to say that maybe I haven't addressed?
Well, when we're talking about hay, we're talking about animals. Most of these animals, their largest contribution, of course, is to feeding our community, and feeding our community is the big deal. So hay, I hope it remains important for the Kachemak country so that we can feed our community. As the hay ground disappears down at the less than 500 foot elevation, it can expand into these Kachemak silt loams. That's the soil that we work on here, is Kachemak silt loam. And first you have to have good soil, then you have to have good terrain, then you have to have good species of grass to start with. Then you gotta have good equipment, and then you might approach, you know, being a hay farmer. So there'll be challenges if the hay production has to move higher. You know, that's what will happen. But I say they're inventing better and better tools for dealing with the variations on the crop. I think tools, techniques, and equipment will show up so that the hay can be produced, you know, at elevation 1500 instead of elevation 5.
And that was Chris Rainwater, recorded at his homestead at the head of the bay on August 18th, 2020. Up next, we hear from Catherine Shakey about invasive species and weed-free hay, straw, and gravel.
Hi, this is Catherine Shakey with Homer Soil and Water Conservation District, and I run the invasive plant program. Invasive plants can be a problem in hay fields throughout the Kenai Peninsula and in Homer in particular. We maintain a list both nationally and within the state of Alaska for those prohibited weeds to be in certified weed-free hay. In order for a farm to certify their hay field as being weed-free, they need a trained inspector to come out and survey the field. Really, the important thing is that there are no propagative parts of the invasive plant that are present in the field and being harvested and then being transferred to other parts of the state. The Alaska Weed-Free Certification Program applies to forage, so hay and straw, and also gravel. The reason for this is that a lot of land managers and just private property owners, livestock owners, are concerned with the introduction and spread of harmful invasive plants. To give you an example, straw is brought all over interior Alaska during the Iditarod annually, and a lot of non-native plants have been introduced to interior Alaska this way. The BLM now requires on any of their land that the Iditarod race runs through that weed-free straw be used. The thing that's really nice about the weed-free programs, it is a nationally managed program, and so the inspectors go through a training that is basically mandated with the North America Invasive Species Management Association. And then the state, in this case, the Division of Agriculture, Dan Coleman with the Plant Materials Center is the main contact for this program, and Cooperative Extension Service helps provide local trainings. And we have a statewide committee that maintains a prohibited weed list. So these inspectors are going into the fields and looking for very specific plants. While I'm on the topic of vectors, you know, it's important to think about how these plants get introduced. And the most economical way to protect moose and salmon habitat is to prevent the introduction of these harmful plants in the first place. That means that cleaning any equipment that is transporting materials across the state. Locally, if you are moving a tractor from the west side of town to the east side of town, you might be hauling some invasive weeds. So please clean your equipment, dirt work contractors, landscapers, any industry folks who are transporting vehicles, ATVs, snow machines. So when I mentioned propagative parts of plants, that's not just seeds. Even if you pick a flower, that flower often has enough energy in it that it can still go to seed and produce viable seed. But also root fragments or stolen fragments can reproduce and sprout new infestations. It's not just seeds we're looking for. It's root wads that might be mashed into some dirt, shoved into a tire crack. Another prime vector for invasive plants in the state is gravel. Gravel gets transported all over the place because these plants thrive in recently disturbed areas. They don't need a lot of nutrients or water. They're very aggressive. The weed-free certified gravel is a really useful tool for maintaining a standard and quality of product. Demand for weed-free gravel is growing across the state. Beginning next year, all new statewide transportation projects are going to require the use of weed-free gravel. If you would like to be certified, or you would like your gravel pit or your hay field certified, you can get in touch with myself at Homer Soil and Water. That's 907-235-8177 and extension 117. You can also email me at Katherine, Katherine, at homerswcd.org. If you live on the central Kenai Peninsula and you'd like to learn about local producers and suppliers of weed-free forage and gravel, you can contact Kenai Soil and Water. Heidi Che there is running that program, 907-283-8732. You can also visit kenaiweeds.org or the Division of Agriculture Plant Materials Center website, and we have lots of details about the programs on those websites. I do want to mention that the Alaska Weed-Free Certification Program is growing, and there are conversations happening across the state about supply and demand. Last spring, we hosted a Know Your Lands talk where we had a lot of horse owners join us for a conversation about what they're looking for in hay. Horse owners are not just interested in getting weed-free hay. They want high-quality hay. They don't want pushkey or cow parsnip in there. We have a lot of equisetum in this area, and we don't want that. Equisetum is horsetail. Also, red fescue is not great for the horses. They also prefer double-compressed bales, which we don't have the ability locally yet to produce. But in other parts of the state, up in Delta Junction, they are producing double compressed bales, and they don't have very much horsetail or pushkey in their hay crops. They've done some nutrition tests of the local brome up in Delta Junction, and it has shown to be very high nutrition for livestock. Other concerns from the horse owners were any chemicals that might be leaving residue in the hay, so mold controls or residual herbicides. Homer Soil and Water is happy to serve as a conduit for connecting producers and buyers together, similar to what we do with local food and agriculture programs. We would love to be able to connect you with those farmers in the area who are already producing certified weed-free hay. We have a list available. We also have a list of inspectors available who can certify fields and gravel pits. A bit more about how the certified weed-free programs work. If you're a hay farmer and you want your field inspected, then we are required to inspect the field within 10 days prior to cutting. So far, folks on the Kenai Peninsula who are selling certified weed-free hay are not asking a higher price for it. However, this is a value-added product. For the gravel pits, the certification is dependent on 2 inspections per growing season. So I just want to reiterate that if you're interested in purchasing weed-free hay, you can contact us at Homer Soil and Water, and we will connect you with existing farmers. Same with the gravel pits. If you're interested in purchasing weed-free gravel, we can connect you with a list of gravel pits that are certified. If you're a farmer who is growing hay suitable for horses and you'd like to get that word out, please contact us. And if you'd like information on how to become a certified weed-free gravel pit or a hay field, we can help you with that inspection process as well. If you are a hay farmer who would like help renovating your hay field, you can contact NRCS, and that phone number is our main line here, 907-235-8177. And as always, if you have any questions about local invasive plants or the Alaska Weed-Free Certification Program, feel free to contact myself, Catherine Shakey, with Homer Soil and Water.
Here's your weekly roundup of agriculture-related opportunities and other fun tidbits. The University of Alaska Cooperative Extension has some fun online workshops coming up. Thursday, August 27th, canning tomatoes. Extension agent Sarah Lewis from the Juneau office will go over selection and preparation of tomatoes, packing jars, acidification, types of tomato products that can be jarred, and will demonstrate both water bath and pressure canning methods. On Saturday, August 29th, canning together with kids. In recent decades, the kitchen skill of preserving food in jars has skipped generations. Let's not let that happen again. Include your kids when you are canning your garden, fish, or game harvest. In this class, Extension Agent Sarah Lewis will cover a water bath recipe and how to safely use a pressure canner with kids in the kitchen. Having a pressure canner is optional. And on Saturday, September 5th, making homemade cleaning products. A few strong chemical cleaners have a place in every home, but most everyday cleaning and even deep cleaning can be done using simpler ingredients. You probably have most of these ingredients in your home already. In this class, you will learn to make simple, effective cleaners with ingredients you can be comfortable having in your home. To get in on any of these classes, visit www.uaf.edu/CES. In other news, the USDA has launched a new annual survey for farmers, ranchers, and private landowners. The survey will help USDA understand what it is doing well and where improvements are needed, specifically at the Farm Service Agency, FSA, Natural Resources Conservation Service, NRCS, and the Risk Management Agency. All farmers are encouraged to take the survey at farmers.gov/survey. It consists of 20 questions and takes approximately 10 minutes to complete. Responses are confidential and individual responses will be aggregated. The survey will be open for at least 5 more weeks. And if you'd like your property to be part of an agricultural study, the Alaska Division of Agriculture's Plant Materials Center is looking for 2-acre to 3-acre plots around the state to conduct alfalfa field trials. They have a cultivar that is ready for testing. Any landowners who might be interested in taking part in the trials can contact the Plant Materials Center at 907-745-4469. A reminder, if you're a local farmer or rancher and you pay to ship tools or feed or other things for your operation up to Alaska, don't forget that the deadline to apply for the reimbursement transportation cost payment is September 4th. That's the program that helps geographically disadvantaged farmers recover some of that cost. Save your receipts and contact USDA Farm Service Agency for those reimbursements. And finally, today and tomorrow, August 22nd and 23rd, Bunnell Street Art Center hosts a land acknowledgement and sign installation at Tugecht, or Bishop's Beach, at the gazebo, part of their Tugecht Land Acknowledgement in Action. Bring house paint or acrylic paint, brushes, recycled wood boards, or old political signs to paint signs acknowledging Indigenous land and place names. Meet 2 to 5 p.m. on Saturday and 12 to 2 p.m. on Sunday, rain or shine.
And that's it. This show was produced at the KBBI studios in beautiful downtown Homer. I want to thank Chris Rainwater for inviting us to his homestead and talking to us about hay. As always, I want to thank Homer Soil and Water Conservation District for contributing content to this episode. I need to acknowledge and thank local musicians Carly Konimak and Kevin Cope for providing the theme music for Homer Grown. Also, local musicians Kevin Cope and Ryan Black for providing the outro music for this show. I heard a rumor that they might be playing an outdoor show at Homer Counts on the Arts the first week of September. So check out their work and their art. And while you're there, check out mine too. I have been your host, Desiree Hagen, reminding you, as always, to support your local farmer.